In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
What's poppin', everybody? Hello and welcome to Popcorn Culture. My name is Ben Carlin and I am your host. Here will be today's my brother Jay, who will be in every episode.
I am here yet again on the pop. I made it back to the show. It's been a good week, Ben. It's been a really busy day. I'll tell you what, this is the fourth show we are recording on this day.
In one day. Yeah, we've done it again, people. We've overbooked ourselves and now we're in a situation where we're trying to use every available minute as effectively as we can. Which, I mean, the real thing here is that, like, the amount of, like, productivity you can create will fit the box that you provide it with. Like,
such is the way.
It's like I can't ever get over the fact that, like, when we have less time we do more faster, and when we have more time we do less slower.
Right. It is unbelievable how it works like that, and, like, always works like that. And I don't feel it's not like procrastination. It's like, that's not what's happening.
No, I don't, you know? Think so. Yeah,
we're never like, I just don't want to do it, or I just don't feel like doing it.
There's something about it that I think, like, I sometimes wonder, because, like, dad's a reporter, and, like, I remember, like, when we were kids, you know, he had, like, a magnet that said, like, you know, not now honey, I'm a deadline, or something like that, and it was just supposed to be like a funny, like, reporter thing. Deadline. It's like, you know, they have no choice but to do everything they possibly can to get the job done.
Right.
And I don't know. Like, I'm like, I wonder if, like, what made dad a good reporter is the same thing that, like, maybe, like, is in our bones. And, like, when we have to go, we can find a way to go. But if we don't have to, then it's like, well, we might go a little bit slower.
Right. Like, if you're just like, if there's, like, a genetic trait that is working to deadline.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and it would be really interesting because, like, nobody obviously could have ever guided us into this career path just because it
didn't exist.
But, like, it's in that way, it would be kind of interesting if, like, if there is a unique talent or something within us that, like, works well with, like, the career we ended up doing, which I would only bring up because it's not like we tried a bunch of careers until we found, like, what worked. You know, we were both sort of, like, on career one and then slowly transitioned into this.
Oh, I procrastinated all the time at my other job.
You did? Okay.
There were certain tasks that were just like, I do not want to do that.
Okay.
It is boring and arduous and time consuming. And there are other things on my to-do list that I could be doing that are way more, you know, maybe not fun, but, like, just, I can do them. I won't mind doing them.
What were you like as a student?
Me as a student?
Yeah, because I think that, like, in my mind, I'm like, Jay was so studious. Like very, you know, like, get it done.
Oh. Hello? Yep. Hello? Okay. Weird little audio blip there.
Hey, I know. Yeah, we don't want that to happen. Yeah, but, like, I always assumed you were just, like, very committed to the craft of being a student.
Well, I think I went through several arcs and valleys of being a student. So, like, through my entire, like, elementary school, you know, run, as it were, I was complete straight A's, never got a B on any report card ever.
Yeah, I was the same way, and I've never been able to figure it out if it was, like, the town that we grew up in, because I was the same way. I also got I was the only student who got straight A's through, like, all of elementary school, which
I mean,
you know, take that as the accolade that it is, but still, you know, the only one, so there was that. And then we moved to, like, the town we currently live in, like, you know, which was, like, 30 minutes, you know, north of where we lived.
Well, prior to that, though, for me, I went to middle school for 2 years.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, that's true. Yep.
So there was, like, my sixth grade experience was, like, I think there was some, like, culture shock in terms of, like, going to different classes and, like, adjusting to, like, you know, maybe a little bit harder classes and stuff like that. And so that was like the first time I ever started getting like B's on my report card. I think I had my first C ever even. I know.
Yes.
I know, which not, you know, even now I'm like, oh man, that was really embarrassing. Like, oh gosh. But then like by the end of seventh grade, I think I really had like my footing back beneath me.
Okay.
Like I had like gotten into a good groove with school. I felt like I understood like this is the rhythm. This is the work required of me. Like, you know, it started feeling important to me again. And I ended up with like all A's and one B at the end of my reading. And I was all, the one B was 1/10 of a point. It was like a 93.4, you know, on a, because we didn't have a 10-point scale. God forbid.
I know.
We had the 6-point scale or whatever.
Seven. What was it?
Yeah. It was that. Yeah, a 94 was an A.
You're right.
Yeah.
Yeah. But like this was, you're right. Like it was like one of those things where it's like, why do this? Like not everyone does this grading scale. Lots of people do the 10-point grading scale. It would completely boost everyone's GPAs. Why do it this way?
Don't know, but they did. And so I remember thinking, and I remember I even ran into that teacher later that summer and was like, oh, like Miss Ross, like I was 1/10 of a point off. And she was like, well, why didn't you tell me that? I would have just given it to you. And I was like, oh. So in my mind, I got straight A's that year.
Okay. Yeah. I think that counts.
Yeah. I'm like, okay, Miss Ross said it. We're good.
Right.
So there's that. And then we moved. That was the year we moved to where we live now in Roanoke, which by the way is only like 40. It's like, you know, say we didn't geographically move very far.
No. Yeah, we're still in the same region of the same state that we've always lived in, and like to the point where our dad was just commuting to the same job from where we lived before.
Right.
You know. So.
Yeah.
Like it's not like he changed jobs or mom changed jobs or something. And we moved. Like he was just closer.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
So and then eighth grade, that was a very difficult time for me. Like I did not want to move. I was extremely upset about it. Cause like I said, I felt like I had just like found my footing and I felt like I really like, you know, had figured out like where I was in the social standing and felt comfortable with everything and, you know, where I was moving forward. And then it just got completely upended. And the school we ended up going to was significantly harder and I was in a terrible place. And just that eighth grade, total wash, not a good year for me.
Sure.
And then I feel like ninth grade moving forward, I kind of like recovered from that. And be, like, I didn't, you know, get to the point where I was like, oh, straight A's or anything ever again throughout high school. But I think I recovered from eighth grade and I was like, I'm doing better than that. And that's good enough. And like that sort of felt good enough to me. Like I wasn't, you know, I wasn't stressing it if I was getting like B's or something as much, which I kind of wish I had, but you know, that's just sort of where it was. And then we also started doing, you know, that's when we started playing like, or doing, you know, like year round sports basically with like, you know, cross country and track and soccer and swimming. And that would all take up a lot of time every night that otherwise. And then, you know, you come home, you not only do you have to do your homework and your practice, but then you also want to have some sort of like social life as well. So that all just started, you know, being a lot as well.
Yes. Yes. I mean, it's oddly reminiscent. I feel like of being a parent to a young child too, though, like, because there is this big, like when you're in high school, you know, you get up early in the morning, you go to school until, you know, 3 o'clock in the afternoon, you've got practice until, you know, 5:30, which is realistically 6, you get home, you know, you have dinner, you do your homework, and then you attempt to squeeze in some amount of like social time before the evening's out, but also you're just exhausted.
Yeah.
You know, and I think it's a lot of the same way, you know, it's like you've got like the small children. So a lot of times, like once they go down at the end of the night, like for bed, even if it's as early as like 7:30 or 8 o'clock, it's like, for one, you got to be up early the next day for work. And two, like, you're tired from the whole day. And three, you can't go anywhere because like now they're, you know, asleep. So it's like you're kind of house locked.
Yeah. 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 So yeah, now I'm looking back, I'm trying to think about college and my first year of college was actually at Radford, was like, I want to say that was really good grades. Like that wasn't an issue. The first semester was really good. Like it was just like, oh, you know what? This was easier than my last year of high school and I don't even really have to try.
Yeah, I would agree that I thought that Radford was easier than high school.
Yeah, there was that. However, then my second semester, that I was, I'm looking back, I'm like, my social standings and my like emotional state were clearly having huge effects on like my grades. Like if it was good, it feels like there's a translation. That was, you know, that was when like me and Beth were having a bunch of like, you know, early long distance troubles and stuff. And then also like the Virginia Tech shootings happened that semester.
Yeah.
And that tanked a ton of people's grades overall because that was happening like around exam times and stuff. And
I mean, from where you are, you know, on Radford's campus, you were like 23 minutes away from Virginia Tech's campus.
You're super close to it, and you just know so many people there because, you know, you went to high school with so many people.
Yes.
And that's, you know, you're still pretty fresh out of that. So that was, the tough. And then I moved to Tech, and then it was like a similar move. It was like, oh, this is harder than the other school, obviously.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But it was like, I think that then it was just sort of back to kind of how my grades usually were. If it was like one of my major classes, I would definitely like try a lot harder in those and focus more on like those classes. But then like, you know, some classes like, you know, comm law, that's just hard. It's just like, you know, that's a difficult. Yeah. Law is just hard.
Law is very hard. Yeah. I took a business law class. In fact, it was the one that where I first saw like Alice from like across the room.
Yeah.
And I ultimately like tried to shoot her a message, you know, because I had seen her across the way. And then like 7 years later, she finally wrote back. But you know that, but you're right. Yeah. That's like one of those classes where it's just like, whew. It's like, you just gotta know, you know, it's like, and it's complex and it's nitty and gritty and detail oriented, and that's the tricky one. But I was the same way too. Like when I got into college, I think especially once I got like into the higher tiers and we were like starting to like build on foundational knowledge, it's like the things that you're dealing with are like a lot harder. But for whatever reason, I was able to grasp those things so much more. It's like because you're like in this like 404 class, it's like you take it really seriously, and it's like, and because it's built on all the bricks that were laid before it, I feel like there is a confidence. There's a familiarity like with this, like the subject matter.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, you know, and that helps. Whereas like in like a 101 class, it's like if you're going into, you know, anthropology 101 and you haven't learned any of it at all and you don't really even know what anthropology is on day one, it's kind of like, what am I doing here?
Right.
What's going on? Who are you? Which department are you in? Like, I don't recognize you from the hallways. Like,
yeah,
you know, it's like this is like,
not usually on this side of campus, I'll tell you that. You
yes,
know?
Yes, yes, yes. I had to pull the map back out as a senior to find my way to this classroom.
Yes, yes.
Right, right. Yes, we got there in the end though. But yeah, no, I mean, it's, I don't know. You're someone who I just basically perceive as responsible.
Well, I mean, to that end, I didn't skip class ever in college.
Well, that's good.
You know, good. Like yeah, I wasn't like, you know, and to that end, I felt like it wasn't. I didn't, you know, I never like just didn't turn in homework. I didn't always do the best at it or any, you know, but, and it's not like I didn't procrastinate and stuff, but I wouldn't like just not do it either.
The homework one, especially, that's one like where I know like a lot of people are like, yeah, I struggled to do my homework. And I was all, like, I mean, I know that it's probably just like anything else, but it wasn't the thing I ever struggled with. Like doing homework always seemed like the easiest way to just buffer your grade.
Right. Because
it was so frequently based on just doing it.
Yeah.
So like most of the time it seemed like the teacher was kind of like, you know, you could have the wrong answers, but if you did it, then you did it. Then you got the check mark.
Right. I feel like what really helped, like this I started doing like my last couple years, was like the syllabuses in college were like really like very specific to like, this is what we'll, like this is what will be due this week. Like down to like papers or quizzes or like small pieces of homework. And sure. I would literally just take all of my syllabuses and tape them against the wall and just like go across them and be like, all right, what's happening this week? And it was like, it was so like that would, you know, and just like, okay, do those things.
What a good pro tip.
Yeah. There you go. Just literally put your syllabuses on the wall. Like, don't be like, yeah, they gave me this first day of class. Pff, see ya.
Right. Right. You know? But you're right too. There was even something kind of like nice about like the first day of class. Cause it's just like, it's syllabus day. Like,
right. Yeah.
We're going to go in, we're going to probably do like some type of icebreaker, you know, be like, hey, my name is Ben, I like onions.
Exactly.
Well, that's Ben, he likes onions.
Right. Yeah. Hey, cool.
Hey,
I know that about you.
Right, right. Okay, so speaking of pro tips, Jay, and actually you kind of touched on this as well, is that like you and Beth were in the early stages of your relationship, but you are currently coming up on your 10-year wedding anniversary.
I sure am.
Hey,
yes.
let's see if we can get the applause button. One second. Uh-oh. One second. Here we go.
Hey, you got it!
Oh!
Nice, nice. Well done.
Thanks. I get to use the soundboard. Yeah, so you're coming up on 10 years of marriage.
Yes.
To Beth. Congratulations.
Yep. Thank you.
What have you learned?
What have I learned in my 10 years of marriage so far? Good question. I would say, like, one of the big things is that, like, it's not about you. Like, the more you can make it about the other person, I feel like the better off your whole marriage is going to be.
Sure.
Like I try to say yes to basically everything, like, that Beth asks. Like, if she wants to, like, you know, go have a night out with her friends, like, I don't think she has ever been like, hey, do you care if I go hang out with the, you know, go to this gathering on Tuesday night?
Right.
You know, I don't think I've ever been like, I really wish you wouldn't, you know, like,
right.
I'd prefer
right.
you just stayed home. Like, I don't think I've ever said that. Just like, whatever it is, I'm just, you know, it's always there. Any like goal or thing she's working towards, I try to be just as supportive as possible and like, either giving her space to accomplish it or doing what I can to assist her accomplish it. Like running marathons and stuff. It's like, it's, you know, for her, it's like a ton of training. There's like tons of like runs and stuff she has to go on like multiple days a week. And a lot of those end up being like on Saturdays and stuff, especially towards the end. That's when you start doing like the long runs. And most people, you know, they do, a lot of them do it on like Saturday mornings and stuff. So, you know, a lot of times like my weekend, the first day of my weekend, like up through like, you know, sometimes noon or so, will just be like me and the kids at the house. And sure. It's just sort of like, you know, that's, you know, you just can't let stuff like that bother you because it is all in the name of like helping her accomplish a different goal. And I think like, and of course it's easy to say that if like when the other person is being reciprocal in that way, because I don't think I've ever also asked Beth anytime where I was like, do you care if I have people over or if I go, you know, play in this Pokemon thing, where she's just been like, no, I don't think that's going to work. It's too busy, you know?
Sure.
Like,
sure,
so sure. I think we both really try and be very like supportive of the other one's like needs and stuff in that regard. I would say the other thing though, is that you also like, you do need to have time for yourself as well.
Yes. Yeah. I know that this has been like a really like big one for you, and you've taken tremendous steps, I think, to accomplish it. Like the mornings, for example, I know that you'll like go to like the coffee shop or to the gym or something. Like after you drop the kids off, it's like, I'm going to go use like the next hour and change to like do a me thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think for the longest time, I felt like, well, if I have extra time, I should absolutely be at work doing work.
See, that's the diligence, you know, I was talking about.
Yeah.
Like the very like studious nature as a former student.
Right. Yeah. Just like, you know, because we have weeks like this where it's like, oh man, we're so slammed. And it would be like, well, if I just have one more hour there early when no one's there, I can really like knuckle down and, you know, get something done.
Sure.
Or something. Or not even that I would always do that, but like sometimes I wouldn't, you know, I would come in and be like, I'm just gonna, you know, play on my computer for a little bit. But I would, if I did that, I would be like, yeah, I would feel guilty because I was like, I know I'm like not doing work right now.
Sure.
As opposed to it being like a firm thing in my mind that like, no, I'm not doing right now. Work has not started yet. This is specifically my time.
Well, and you know, it's interesting too. I mean, and I know we've talked about this before on the pod, but like it's sort of like that question of like, it's so difficult to know what everyone else in their own respective jobs and roles and day-to-day life are doing. Especially when you are self-employed and the only real metric that is determining your success or failure is, you know, it's essentially how much are you willing to put into it?
Exactly. Exactly. You know? And you sort of feel like, well, I'm throwing away, you know, my opportunity if I'm not putting every second to the grindstone, you know?
Right. Which is, you know, certainly I can understand the same thing. Like there will be times like I'm, you know, I've like brought it up before, but we've got like a rubber basketball in my eye line that looks like a rubber duck. And there are like, you know, the occasional moments where you and I will just go out into like the main area and just literally pass the ball back and forth.
Right.
For 15 minutes.
Right.
And sometimes I'm like, well, you know, we always say we're so busy, but we also spent 15 minutes passing a ball back and forth. But I also think there's something to be said for the fact that it would be utterly unsustainable to go as hard as we are going for 8 consecutive hours. Like, I would suspect that most jobs, most people doing work are finding themselves like either procrastinating, either just kind of taking like a stalled break, you know, or even just simply being bored instead of working.
Oh, I know. If you're at work for 40 hours a week, like how many hours of that time are you working, you know?
Which, yeah, it's a very difficult question to kind of know the answer to in like a broad spectrum kind of way. Like, you know, you can go and chat with your buddies who like work different kinds of jobs and ask them, you know, like, what is your day-to-day like? Well, you know, and like sometimes it sounds like you're like, well, I can never do that, you know, like that sounds so hard. And then other times it's like, well, that actually sounds like okay, you know,
right.
Like not too bad. I could handle that. I want to back up though to something else that you brought up, because it actually fits perfectly with a discussion topic that I had that had nothing to do with it.
Okay.
But you were talking about like you and Beth always kind of like saying yes, you know, in terms of like helping one another, like in terms of like that's good like relationship advice.
Right.
And part of me would be curious, like, is that something you learned along the way? Was that something that you guys like discussed? Like what got you there? Because I have a piece of information that would reinforce the sentiment that's a very good thing to do that I'll elaborate on, but I want to see kind of like where you were at first.
I don't know. We haven't like specifically ever said that to each other.
Okay.
I think I've just sort of learned that over time. Like it's just like, yeah, over time, it's definitely, I've just learned that like the more you can like give to the other person, the more like even just tiny acts of like kindness you can do for your significant other, like the better. And it's like, you know, there's almost no reason that they're asking you to do it just because like they're too tired to do it. It's,
oh, yeah.
Or, you know, it's not just like, you know, oh, Beth is never just like sitting on the, you know, couch scrolling on her phone, just like, hey, can you go fold the laundry? And, you know, it's not like that.
Yeah. No. I understand.
Yeah.
Well, the reason I ask is because yes, there, I was looking at a couple of different, like psychological effects that I found that were kind of interesting. And it started with something called the IKEA effect. And
okay.
Here's like the technical you're yawning already.
No, I'm not.
Here's the technical. It's because
this is the fourth show we're doing today.
That's okay. That's okay.
You're saying, like, this is unsustainable. I'm like, it was hardly sustainable on today.
That's true. Yeah. That's true. Yes. But we're making it. So the IKEA effect. The IKEA effect is a cognitive bias in which consumers place a disproportionately high value on products that they partially created. And I think Harvard did the study once upon a time, but basically like people were brought in and given the opportunity to like build a shelf or something like that. And then like at the end of it, they were like, hey, would you like to buy it? And like, you know, what do you think would be like a fair price? And the amount that people who actually built the shelves themselves were willing to pay for the shelf was much higher than people who just walked in and were asked, how much would you pay for this shelf? So it's almost like once you have put your mark, once you have contributed to the overall like completion of something, and it could be something from a piece of furniture, or it can be, you know, much more open-ended, you're more invested in the finished product.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, and
I mean, this is true of just everything, right?
Well, I think that you could easily apply this to like, you know, we've been talking so much about like gardening and yes, a little bit even about like how much effort are we putting into to getting what at the end of the season is probably like a few baskets worth of produce that like we could easily go to the grocery store and spend $50 and probably have as much of.
Oh, I know. Right. I mean, that is exactly where my brain went to, was like, oh yeah, like gardening is a great fit for this. It's just like we've, you know, built the fence. I've tilled the land. I bought the materials. We go out. I've weeded it a bunch. You know, I was throwing down mulch this past weekend.
Yes.
You know, and it's like that makes it so much better. But even like I can, you know, this could be even just be like, like I can't even think about like Pokemon cards like this, where it's like there, you know, it's one thing to go online and look at like what deck just won the most recent regional tournament and just like build that exact deck.
Sure.
And you know, you can go and you can practice, you can get good with it. That's fine. But it's like, it will never feel as good as if you just built the deck from scratch, which there's this, I feel like sometimes what I get frustrated with like games like that are like trading card games or like Diablo or something,
sure,
is the fact that it's like the information is almost like too free or something. Or,
yes. You know, like the most optimal thing you can do is information that has been like boiled down.
Right.
It's been, you know, distilled into a concrete answer.
Right. It's like the way the information flows so freely makes it like so less appealing to discover it for yourself, because you can just like, you know, you can just go online, and it's like, especially if it's something you're just doing casually, like, you know, I'm not, you know, out there trying to like break new ground on Diablo 4 or something.
Sure.
You know, I've got like maybe 2 hours a week where I could like sit there and actually play it. So, you know, if I want to use that time, what feels like the most optimally, it's like, yeah, I'll just, you know, why would I waste time just building a bunch of stuff that like isn't going to end up working or anything. But so, you know, you can just look up, I want to do this kind of character, and boom, here's an, you know, 10 different stat sheets that say you can build it these ways. They'll all work. Try and hunt down this gear, try and get these things. And there you go. You'll be set.
Yeah.
Whereas like that's fine. But it's like on the flip side, like we're playing on our gaming hangout once a month with Dola, Diablo 2.
Yes.
And she is not doing this. They're not looking up like optimum builds, and her husband are playing. And what they're doing is just going through the game, and they're trying to like find characters whose abilities complement each other. And every time they find a really good synergy, they're just like having a blast suddenly like using that combination to go through the new levels that they can now accomplish.
Yes.
And
exactly.
She's just like, it's like, we're having so much fun. We're just like laughing on the couch. It's just like, it's so great when we find the right combination. Just like, yeah, that's exactly it. That's exactly it. I think like that is why sometimes what's so alluring to me about like a brand new game or something, where it's like stuff hasn't been figured out yet, because it just feels so free to just try it. But once it's been out there for like 2 or 3 years, it's like people kind of know,
right?
Like it's the meta is there. It's not like it's impossible to break it or anything, but it's like it becomes really, really difficult.
You know, I'd be curious about this as well. Like if sports, when they're like kind of gaining popularity a little bit, like I'm thinking about your triathlon at one point in time where, like on some level, if you were presented with the idea of you were going to go and do an event that is swim, bike, run, it's like basically you're compounding three major endurance related sports and you have to participate in all of them inside of like one day. On day one, when the people are sitting around the campfire being like, you know, that'd be a fun challenge, why don't we give that a go? It's like just simply being able to do all three sports, challenge enough. And then maybe it's kind of like, okay, like more people are kind of like, all right, I want in on that. Like I could be down to partake. And so it's like, you know, then you've got like some more people going on, and then it's getting like a little bit more competitive. And then at some point in time, somebody's like, okay, I've realized if you start taking your wetsuit off the second you get out of the water, then by the time you get to your bike, you're already stripped down. You can just hop right on your bike and go. I've optimized that part of the equation.
Right.
And then from there, you start to have more and more and more and more. It's like, you know what? I just wear my running shorts underneath my swimsuit, ride my bike in my running shorts, so that eventually when it comes to the run, I'm just running in those. I don't have to do anything.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, and you're starting to realize like, okay, like, and I bet at first when you're making those like little like, oh, like things are clicking, it's like, dude, that improved my time. Like that's very satisfying.
Right.
It feels really good. But then once you like show up to something that's so well established, these almost feel like the baseline standard.
It's like the drive-thru window.
Yes. So and I've given this example before, but it's the order winner versus the order qualifier. So let's say you've got two different hamburger companies, you know, across the street from each other, and they both just serve, for all intents and purposes, a fast food burger. You know, you walk in, you order at the counter, they give it to you on a tray, boom, bam, you go sit down, you eat your burger, and you leave. It all happens rather quick, and it's nice and unhealthy and perfect in all the ways that we like fast food to be. And then, you know, guy across the street throws on a window and is like, hey, you don't have to get out of your car. It's like, you can just come right on around.
Right.
It's sort of like all of a sudden, everybody who used to just go in and decide that day between this joint or that joint is like, well, this one, I don't even have to get out of my car. I can just go right around the window.
Right.
All of a sudden, it starts to win the business. It's novelty. And then at some point in time, it's kind of like, if you put the guy across the street who doesn't have the drive-thru window out of business, then in order to compete at all, you must have a drive-thru. It used to be an order winner. It used to make it unique, but now it's an order qualifier. If you want to play the game, you got to do it.
Right.
And yeah, you're right. Like that's something that I think that can really start to come in and maybe like start to, even if you're having a good time, because like what you're ultimately doing is like succeeding, it can feel a little bit less like you get to own the success. It's like you read the book on all of the order qualifiers.
Right. But I mean, like even going the act of like reading the book can be like helpful.
Because sometimes, yes, yeah. You're right. Yes.
Right.
Absolutely.
But like, yeah, but like, you know, net decking or something is what they call it when you just look up your deck online.
Sure.
Or whatever. It just feels a little like, you know, okay, I did, but like, did I come up with it or whatever? Like, I'm playing, you know, Pokemon Pocket on my phone right now.
Sure.
And like the deck I'm currently using, it is, sure enough, I just, you know, I net decked it because whatever. I was like, what's the best one? What's the best one? What if I just go in there and just do that, see if I can climb the ranks real quick? And it just wrecks people.
Yeah.
It's just like why wouldn't you? If all you want to do is win, just yeah.
just do that.
Just do it. It's just like I think my current record with it is like 28 and like 4 or something. You know?
Sure.
It's just like, yeah, it's just good. But it's not nearly as fun as like the deck I was using in the last season where I just built it out of scratch and I didn't see anyone else run my cards. And it was just like every time it worked, which was still pretty frequent, it was just like, yep, you didn't see that coming. And you could know. You could play the game based on no one knows what's about to happen.
Right.
Whereas like the one I'm running right now, I've you know, I've won a bunch, but there's mirror matches all the time because everyone's on the same thing.
Yeah.
Everyone's like, oh, yep, I'm playing against the mirror match. And, you know, you have to maybe learn the nuances of that. But like, I, you know, now it's not like I can sit there and rely on the fact that, you know, oh, they're going to make this a bad play because they don't understand what I'm about to do.
Right.
And I know they don't know, and I can actually use that against them.
Okay.
As opposed to like, well, they know exactly what I'm going to do so they can play around it.
Sure.
Yeah. And anyway, that's all.
Okay.
Go ahead though.
Well, no. So yeah, cause I even have more still because, so there, what I basically presented to you was the IKEA effect, which is basically this cognitive bias where you have a higher value on the products that you were somehow involved with, which
right.
I think you and I both clearly can clear as day find the example. But then there's something else that I think is kind of like even more interesting as well. Because there is a different effect called the Ben Franklin effect. And this I think is kind of interesting because it means that what the Ben Franklin effect might suggest is that you're doing things for Beth and her doing things for you reinforce your feelings towards each other by actively making the decision to help each other. And so it means that you like Beth more by doing things for Beth. And Beth likes you more by doing things for you.
Right. It's not like Beth likes me more because I did things for her.
Yes,
right.
That's the distinction. And so this was like the thing that Ben Franklin came up with at some point in time was that he had a rival politician. And so what he did was he went up to that person and asked them if he could borrow a rare book from their collection. And in doing so, this rival of his like made the decision and agreed and said, yes, you can borrow my rare book. And like what that psychologically did inside of the rival's mind was tell him like you were willing to do a nice thing for this person when asked a favor. And
right.
Then what Ben Franklin found after that was that they had far more cordial exchanges because this person had done them a favor.
Right.
Like, and I think that sometimes this can be true. Like if you go over to a person's house and they offer you something to drink, you might think that the polite thing to do is to not burden them, you know, by saying like, yes, can I have a lemonade? You know, because it's like, well, then I'm taking some of your lemonade and I don't want to like take things from your,
yeah, I don't give you a chore.
Yeah. These are your groceries. And now I'm just showing up and getting a free beverage just because I'm here. And so like a lot of times that used to be like, I used to always be like, oh no, thank you. I appreciate the offer though. But then what I eventually realized is that if somebody is able to then play guest, it is just as good for them. Or a play host, rather, it is just as good for them as it is then for you.
Right.
Like, so sometimes it's better to accept the offer of their hostmanship.
Right. Like, you think you're being polite by saying no.
Correct.
Right. You're like, oh, I acknowledge that you offered me a drink. You know, formalities have been observed.
Yeah, yes, right. Yes.
Thank you.
Right, right. But I think it's probably ultimately better for both parties to do this thing.
Right.
So then there's a whole bunch of examples of different ways that this sentiment can be applied. And I was sort of like, man, this is just like broad spectrum, very useful advice that I think a lot of people could put to use. And I think that it's possible that I was unknowingly doing at least this first one in high school, which would be making friends with a bully.
Ah.
So asking a bully for help with something.
I see.
And basically it's sort of like, and apparently like teachers can be known to do this with like students who are known to like act out a little bit more, be like, you know, Timmy, could you help me set out the chairs today? And it's like by being recognized and granted the responsibility of assisting in something as important or unimportant as setting up the chairs, that student may feel recognized. And then at least within the confines of that particular class, behave better.
Right.
So it's kind of like if you're dealing with somebody like who is like difficult in terms of your interactions with them, then maybe a good piece of advice would be to just simply ask them to help you with something.
Right.
And see what happens from there.
Right.
You know, which I was like, okay, that's sort of amazing. Politicians do this a lot. Like, a lot of times a politician doesn't just ask you for a vote. They will ask for a small donation, as like something that you can do to help their cause. And apparently the psychology behind asking for the donation isn't necessarily that like your $1 is going to go and help them, you know, purchase so much more ad space. It's that like, by you granting them the $1, it's like whose campaign have you ever financially contributed to and then not voted for?
Well, yeah, exactly. Right.
Right. I mean, yeah. And maybe on some level it's like, okay, you're looking at it all wrong and like that's not the way it aligns, and you would never contribute to a campaign that you weren't going to vote for in the first place.
Right.
You know, but maybe that's the case. Like, you know, maybe by being simply asked, it put the opportunity on the table to do it. And then in doing it, boom, bam, they've effectively secured your vote.
Right.
You know, which is not necessarily a bad thing. You know, I mean, it just kind of makes sense.
Like, right.
That's what they're doing, you know, instead of it. But yeah, so then the final installment here would be the romantic relationships and emotional investment. If you go out of your way to plan something thoughtful for your partner and feel closer to them because of it, it's not just that they're lovable. It's that your effort convinces you that they were worth the effort you put in to do the nice thing.
Right.
So like if you set up a romantic date, you like the person more because you set up a romantic date.
Right.
Cool, right?
It makes sense. Yeah.
And I think it's interesting because like one of my lessons that I feel like I've learned, you know, in my marriage, which, you know, I'm not quite up to the shakes that you and Beth are at. You know, we're only at the halfway mark.
Oh, man.
To 10 years or anything. But I do think that there's like this, like, you know, marriage is a choice. Like this is something that you like. It is not this thing. It's easy to think because so many stories end with and they lived happily ever after that. Once you found your person, you just get to go and live happily ever after.
Right.
Like it ignores the obvious challenges of life, of right. which there are many, you know, like
yes.
life is not always just going to be this straightforward and smooth path. And so, but I think that the way that like what it means to choose your marriage and to choose to love this person is to continue to do these things because these things continue to reinforce your own feelings.
Right. I agree. That's what, I mean, the more that, and that just goes back to it. Just, you know, if you can just say yes to whatever it is, or like, you know, like one of the things I like to do in the morning is just bring Beth like a coffee before she gets up, because a lot of times I'll just be up before her and I'll be downstairs and I'll pour them. And like, I don't, you know, I'll just bring hers up because I know she's going to get up soon. And it's always nice to have coffee in bed.
Oh my gosh. I've bragged on you on this so many times, yeah. But you do this on tour and it is the most amazing thing. It's like, I'm just always sort of like, you know, like you open your eyes to like the sound of a cup being placed in front of you. And it's like, what is this?
No effort required.
Yes. It's like, okay, I'm up. I can do this. Anyway. Yeah. So that's our life advice with Jen and Bay for the day.
There you go. Yeah. You're welcome.
Yeah. Transition.
Mm-hmm. Transition.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week.
Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week.
Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.
Life's better with American Family Insurance, because we know in making the most of your home, DIY doesn't just stand for do it yourself. It also means dream it yourself. And we're here to help protect the dreams you're building. Save up to 23% when you bundle home and auto. American Family Insurance. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
Okay, Jay. It has been a long time since I've actually consumed the show Black Mirror.
Yeah, I agree with you. When you start watching, you're like, oh my gosh, that was such a weird thought experiment. And then you watch like 6 or 7, you're like, I really got to like psych myself up to watch this show. You know?
That is exactly how it is.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like I feel like I found Black Mirror like in the early days of this idea of like binge watching TV. And I think what almost happened was I binge watched it too much and it weighed on me for literal years, and it was almost like you sip this show,
right?
You know, like this is like a strong whiskey. This is not like a, like, I don't know, your morning protein shake.
Yeah. You can't just sit there. It's way too much to take in.
Right.
Like the situations they present just feel like, well, what if that happened?
Oh, I know. Yeah. Like sometimes they're just like a little bit too eerie. But I was sort of having like an interesting thought experiment about just money. Like money can feel like one of the most taboo subjects there is. And I think it's sort of like, it's strange because at our core, like with being, you know, like in a more modern society, so frequently it's not the case that your day-to-day job is going and planting seeds in a field to grow food, to feed your family, that like, you know, you sowed the seeds, you harvested the fruits of your labor, you fed your family with the food, you know, cycle, rinse, repeat, look to the skies and hope that it rains.
Right.
Like, you know, it's like we like find ourselves in positions where it's like we try to achieve an education of some magnitude in order to be qualified to perform a job that will pay us an income. That means that we don't typically have to go hand to hand with dirt.
Right.
You know, planting those seeds, so to speak.
Yeah.
So it's like it's a big focus for all of us. It's what retirement hinges on. It's what, you know, you're sometimes probably even what your general sense of safety can revolve around. So the question is, what if there was just like the number? And this, I mean, it feels like a Black Mirror episode. For all I know, it just is a Black Mirror episode. But there's a number above your head that tells you, that tells everybody your whole net worth.
Right.
So you walk around and your net worth is just bobbing above your head. It's like, I personally think it could be super interesting right away, because I think that something that many of us just can't resist doing is finding ways to make it appear as though we are affluent, you know, wearing nice clothes, driving nice cars, living in a specific zip code. Like, you know, there is like the flex culture of it all, like,
right.
Sort of like, look what I've been able to accomplish. I can go to one of those fancy over the water cabanas with the thatched roof, and you can jump right out into the ocean, and, you know,
yeah, right,
like,
right,
like
right.
That the, like, not that it's not that 0% of the reason that people do that particular vacation in the Maldives is because it's an extraordinary experience and probably one that is, you know, on some measure once in a lifetime, but also the Instagram photo makes you look pretty dang baller.
Well, that's true. It does. It looks like, you know, you're doing okay for yourself.
Right.
Yeah.
But what happens to the number above your head when you do those types of activities?
Oh, do you mean like it goes down?
It goes down.
Right.
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 So then what does it do to those behaviors?
Like, would you like not, you mean like, would you just not do them?
What would you not do them? Or it's like, do you want to look wealthy or do you want to be wealthy?
Well, I would imagine that a lot of the people on those vacations, their number would go down, but they would still appear quite wealthy.
Well, I mean, I think that there's probably something to be said for that.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think
most people on those vacations just spent everything they had on it.
Okay. Well, how about like a fancy pair of shoes then?
Okay. Okay. I mean, it's such a tricky question because it's like, you're trying to answer it within the context of the real, like, I feel like it's hard to think about this in the context of the real world, because if everyone could constantly see everyone's number all the time, I feel like that might change the way you felt about how you spent money all the time.
I definitely think it would change just about everything.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, but I think that there's an argument to be made where it's like, you could look at it and be like, you know, like let's say somebody had $250 above their head, but they live this great big extravagant life with all these crazy vacations and, you know, like all of the status related symbols that we've kind of like come to know about the world.
I'm
kind of imagining like Keeping Up with the Kardashians, like that kind of sort of like vibe or lifestyle or whatever. It's like, on some level, would you be like, dang, I'm very impressed that you are scrappy enough to be able to have put together all of what you do, and the number above your head is $250.
Or would you think like, man, you need to save some money?
Or would you think that?
Yeah.
Yes. Right. Exactly. Like, would you still envy any of those types of things the same way? Like, if we were just like more candid about these things, would it actually make us like more or less, maybe like materialistic or, you know, like, I don't know.
My suspicion is that in this scenario, extremely rich people would be way more willing more of the time to be generous with their wealth.
Yeah. Okay. Okay.
Because people could see just how much more money they had than they needed.
Sure.
At all times, because like the flip, like, I mean, I think that would be a big effect, because it would almost be like right now, you know, it's impolite a lot of times to even just ask like, how much money do you make? Like, what's your net worth? Like, you know, that would be,
sure,
you know, that's generally considered like rude or whatever. But if everyone just knows this all the time and always,
right,
then it's sort of like, you know, if you see someone over there sitting with like $7.5 million just floating over their head for whatever reason,
sure,
and you're sitting over here, like I think to them it would be like, I think you would feel really embarrassed all the time that you weren't helping when you have to constantly be exposed to the numbers on everyone else's head.
Right. Yes. I mean, and that's a very good point, because like, you know, especially if you walk into a room and your number's the biggest by 30,
right,
then and you know, like there's just anybody who needs help at all, it's kind of like, well, like, everybody kind of knows that I've got more than enough. You know,
I imagine there would be something to that. I also imagine it would be really difficult if you had like a really large number to ever know if people were being genuine with you.
Sure. You know? Like, or would people just be like wanting something from you?
Right. They're like, you know, I can absolutely, you know, I can ask you for just about anything. And, you know, of course I want to be nice to you because I can see that you might be able to give me money or
sure,
whatever.
Sure. Right. Sure. But that's also true, I think, sometimes with the other status symbols as well. You know, it's like, I think that's why people wear the status symbols on some level is because it should invite attention, but then nobody wants to be liked for their money. They want to be liked for who they are.
You think most people's status symbols are fake representations of their status?
I don't think they're necessarily fake representations of their status, but the very nature that anybody is wearing anything on the basis of status is on some measure, not across the board. I mean, in some cases you're talking about like a better overall product. You know, it's right. Sort of like, it's like this rain jacket repels water better than the other rain jacket because it's made with better Gore-Tex technology or something like right. that. So it's not that there's no practical effect to the additional expense ever, but I think that certain things that are status related, probably like that has to be feeding in psychologically through our, you know, our lizard brains somehow. And part of what we think is that, well, people will like me if I have this,
right?
You know, people will like me if I, you know, if I am able to exist at an echelon that I think they will like me at.
You think that, okay. So just so I'm understanding that you think by wearing like a more expensive shirt, the psychology is that people would like you more because they recognize that it's an expensive shirt.
I think so.
Okay.
I believe that would certainly be the case. Like, I mean, I think we've talked about it before even, and it doesn't have to be like a shirt. Like take like the people who drive like the car with the really, really loud, like muffler.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, I suspect that somewhere in the psychology of the game of loud mufflers, it was the case that it was like, ooh, like a louder purr from the vehicle, from the engine suggests a faster car, and a faster car suggests a greater amount of like either know-how,
risky behavior.
Either know-how, risky behavior, like kind of like edgy, you know, like
right.
like there's something to it, or income, you know, like they are capable of purchasing a better piece of equipment. And then the game goes on and on and on and on and on, and people get lost somewhere along the way, and they just think more noise equals better equals always. And it's like, maybe at some point in time, it's just inconvenient. It's just problematic.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's just become like an issue.
Yeah. I will say, okay, not to relate everything back to Pokemon cards.
But you know what? If it's what helps you explore the example.
Okay. So I will say that I am guilty of trying to use this tactic as an intimidation tactic in games of Pokemon.
So because when it comes to Pokemon cards, there are often rare versions of cards and then there are common versions of cards that fundamentally in gameplay do the same thing.
Right.
One's harder to find.
Right. You can go and, you know, buy like a starter deck or whatever, and it'll come with, you know, four copies of Level Ball, right? It's just like a common basic card. It is in, you know, every deck. It lets you search a Pokemon or whatever. But then you could have the, you know, reverse holo version of the Level Ball, or you could find, like, if you're really lucky, you could have like the gold version of the card,
right,
or whatever. And the gold version, like, you know, a lot of people would just stick it in their binder. They wouldn't play it. Why would you do that? That's, you know, that's worth money or whatever. But then there's some people who like to just like bling out their deck so that like every single card is of the coolest or rarest version of the card that they could have.
Right. Yes.
Or whatever.
Yeah.
And the psychology I feel like that goes through it is that if you like, so most, like a lot of people wouldn't, because it's just not cost effective to, you know, do it. Like you don't need to do it to play the game at a competitive level.
Right.
And there are even people I like, you know, to me, it would be like, oh yeah, if you were like the number one player in the world, I bet your whole deck is blinged out all the time, you know, but
sure.
It's not. That's like, there are top players who are like, yeah, I just get like one copy of each card that I need and that's it. And it's the common version. And that's about it, you know.
The bling for me is winning the match,
exactly.
Not the shiny card.
Right, exactly. And they're going to be against such high-level opponents anyway that such factors would not ripple them in any way.
Sure.
But if you're just a regular, you know, plebe down there sitting at table 320 on round three, you know, you might be able to get away with some other sort of edge type advantages here.
Sure.
So the tactic would be that if your deck is completely blinged out and you're putting down things like gold energy cards, which are otherwise the most common things, then to your opponent, it might look like, wow, this person has invested a lot in this game. And if they've invested this much money into their deck looking good, they didn't do that because they suck at this game.
Sure. Yes. Right. Yes.
Yeah.
So it's like you're looking at the status symbol and you're taking the associated connotations with it.
Right.
Like I remember in high school, it felt like there was a degree of this going on because like you drove a BMW and I drove a Mercedes. And what does that say about us?
Yeah. And it has a certain look to it.
It certainly does. But the thing that I think a lot of people tend to not know about import vehicles is that like at a certain age, the cost drops rather dramatically. And at some point, these actually become quite affordable vehicles because they are prone to breaking down and the repairs are very expensive. And so like a lot of people who do like luxury cars in those name brands are typically doing something where they're like they could be cycling through the vehicle on like a lease basis where like they want to always have the latest and greatest every couple of years.
Right.
It's like you want to live at the top. You want to live at the cutting edge. You always want to have the shiny new, the newest technology, the best heated and cooled seats and whatever the case may be. But because the people at the top can afford to basically cycle through vehicles like this, Mercedes and BMWs maintain a very high relationship with their badges. Like when people see that, it means something. But in the meantime, the actual reality is they're kind of affordable,
right?
At the rate at which we got them,
right?
Like these were not super expensive cars. They were not, you know, fresh off the lot. They were nice cars. I mean, and we, you know, had fun in them and stuff like that. They ran for us, but
yeah,
they also broke down. And I feel like on more than one occasion ended up in the shop, and on more than one occasion it was expensive to fix. And
right. Of course it was all that.
Yeah. It was a headache.
Yeah. All that was true too, but yeah, you're right. There was sort of like a, like, you know, oh, what kind of car do you drive? It's like, oh, I have a BMW. And it's like, oh, it sounds like, oh, well, like James Bond. And it's like, oh, no, it's not.
No.
It's, you know, I almost wish I didn't, because it always sounds way cooler than it is.
Well, that's what I mean. Yeah.
It's like, because you're going to come see it and it's just going to look like just a car.
Yeah.
It's just a car.
The last time we went through a safety checkpoint, they thought for sure that we were stashing some type of, you know, paraphernalia underneath the floor mats, because the rubber underneath of them was just degrading.
It was just degrading.
So it kind of looked like ashes, but instead it was just degraded rubber.
Just degraded rubber. You know how it is.
Yeah. You know how it is.
Mm-hmm. So anyway, I do know what you mean. I like to try and bling out my deck when I can for the competitive value.
Sure.
Maybe that doesn't work on other people at all, but if I feel like it could work, then it placebos me into having more confidence. So
well, there's also that.
Yeah.
That I feel like kind of goes back to the example we had earlier, which is like the do nice things for your spouse, and it's not because it will make them like you more, it will make you like them more,
right?
You know, because that's how the psychology behind it works.
Exactly.
Which is not a bad thing. But so then the next question that I think might kind of fit neatly into this equation is that, like, I wonder if there would become like an ideal number that you could have resting above your head. Because on some level, if you walk into a room and you've got three more zeros than anybody else, like, there is a chance that this is going to have diminishing returns quickly. Like, it might become problematic that you have like accumulated so much.
Right.
Like people don't want to see that many zeros. Like maybe it stops being a status symbol at some point and just seems like excess. Like I think I made a joke in a video we made on Super Carlin Brothers that like a well-seasoned steak is not made better by adding more seasoning to it.
Right.
Like at some point in time, the right amount of seasoning was the correct amount of seasoning. More is not inherently better.
Right.
Which, you know, that's not really the general perspective. I'm just curious if like, you know, what if it became the case that like the true ideal golden retriever sticking its head out the back of the Forerunner version of wealth is like, you know, like $67,000.
Right.
You know, and it's like most people would be kind of, because I think that they say that, you know, and I'm sure with inflation and stuff, this number may have changed. But at some point in time, people said no more additional happiness is found after you've made $75,000 a year.
Sure. And that, yeah, I'm sure that number floats around and stuff.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Based on whatever. But or I think you made an example the other that you were telling me about over lunch. That was sort of like you can go to work and you can work hard, but working hard doesn't make your life less stressed. You're just stressed in a nicer room.
Right. Like it. Yeah. Like, you know, promotions aren't going to bring you like more peace. They're just going to bring you stress in a nicer place.
Yes. Yes. Right. Like the phrase more money, more problems feels like cliche to bring up. But like even as somebody who enjoys like things like my boat, it's like I am now aware of the fact that like every time the temperature drops below, you know, 32 degrees, I'm actively worried that one of my pipes is going to burst because my boat sits outside.
Right.
And it's like, if I had like 7 boats, it might be fun to have a boat for every single possible occasion you could possibly ever think of. But then I would have to worry about that exact problem times 7.
Sure.
You know, and then yeah. throw other toys into that. And it's like, well, now these are all problems too.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's like, that would be like an interesting question where it would almost be like, would it ever become the case if these numbers are floating above your head and you're trying to figure out like, you know, what is the thing you want to see in the person, you know, like what does that ultimately become? That would even be kind of interesting because I do think that you're right. I think that there would be a greater degree of generosity if, you know, people just could walk around and see what's up above your head. And
right.
Like, it's like, hey man, you know, there's like these people could use some help and you've got it.
Yeah. You got it right there, man.
Right.
Yeah. I can definitely see that. I can also see a situation where there's like a bunch of like then people who do have a lot of wealth just like really seclude themselves away to like because they're greedy and they don't want to face like the judgment.
You don't want to face the judgment, but then even that is kind of like it's its own kind of telling though, isn't it?
Yeah, like, I mean it is. So if this is like doing your net worth though, would most people not like, you know, if you have like a mortgage, is your net worth not going to be just like in the negative for a long time?
Oh, it certainly could be.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, I mean, this is like, you're walking around and just like, oh, you got a big old negative number up there. Like, you know, if you see anyone in the green, oh, that's like, whoa.
Well, maybe that becomes its own thing.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Or maybe it's sort of like that becomes like the equivalent of like, it's like, yeah, like they're like 43 years old and it's like they're still not in the green yet. I mean, that is no basis on anything. I'm not trying to like make a point with 43, but like this might be the kind of thing where it's generally accepted, you know, like debt, I guess when it really comes down to it, is not always inherently a bad thing. Like I was reading an article with like the national debt the other day. It's like the goal would probably be with the national debt to never make it zero. Like, the national debt on some level is just the same as like your mortgage. It's just allowing you to do certain things over a much greater period of time.
Right.
Not to say we should always accumulate more debt or anything either, but sometimes it makes sense. So maybe at that point in time, it's sort of like, at what point in time do you break through? Or does that become like an accolade that like someone you're dating might tell their parents? It's like, yeah, they're 24 and they're in the green.
You know? Right.
Like,
yeah.
It's like, whoa.
Do you imagine if you have like an extremely negative number, like you're going up to get a Starbucks and the guy's like, sure about that?
You sure about that?
You sure?
I don't feel right about this.
Yeah. I don't know if I can tell you this, man.
Right.
There is an episode of Black Mirror that is like this, but instead of it being money, it's like your, it's like if everyone has like a 5-star review.
Yes.
And like the, like, you know, like airline, you know, I think, you know, the main character is like really trying to like amp up her star level because it's like, you know, basically like celebrity status, if you can move it upwards or downwards. And she keeps having these bad situations that drop it below. And, you know, she was sitting at a comfortable like 3.7 at the start, but like, you know, she quickly drops below like 3, and then like certain airlines are like, well, we don't really allow people who aren't at a 3 or higher to come on the airline because we can't really trust them or whatever.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. And then I think that the point of this particular episode is to start to see the, like the
It's like a rich get richer situation.
Rich get richer, poor get poorer, exactly. Because it's kind of like, all of a sudden, if you keep being denied access to everything, like, then your life becomes...
How are you supposed to move up?
How are you supposed to move up? Your life becomes a lot more frustrating. You keep being, like, you know, not permitted access to opportunities. And because of that, like, it's sort of like, you as a person are, like, you're closer to you might live more, like a more ongoing, frustrated... like you know, it's like it's harder to feel like that sense of like safety or calm or something, because you can't rely on this thing to you know, give you access. It's a great working analogy.
Yeah.
And I think that probably was the exact episode that I was thinking of when I was thinking about this particular concept. So let me throw one last caveat into it before we close out today's episode. Do you think then, let's say there's a number above your head, and it doesn't mean you're in the negative, but it's just the number above your head that is in red is just your net worth. So, like, you know, it can be whatever that amount of money is accumulated to. Below that in green is how generous you've been.
Because
then imagine you walk in, you've got the person with 3 zeros at the end of their number, and you're kind of like, wow, that's unbelievable. But that's the red number. The green number is zero.
Zero. Right. Not so good.
Less good.
Less good.
Less good. But then take, for example, what if their number is 1 million, you know, more zeros than most of us will probably have. But that's their red number. That's their net worth. But then their green is like 28 million.
Right.
Can you justify the million?
Right. Then you're just like, well,
Right.
Right. This person they're doing a lot. Yeah.
Right. Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. It's like they've realistically given away most of it.
Right.
You know, and from there, it's like, you know, would that be a way that you could then balance what a good number was? Like, maybe then it's the ratio that really starts
your ratio
starts to demonstrate more.
Well,
of your character.
Okay, but then so let's say you've got, you know, someone who it says 1 million or whatever, and their green number is then like 5 million or something,
sure.
Right? Like, yeah. Okay, cool, $6 million, whatever. But then you've got someone who's like, you know, 50, like maybe it's like 50,000 is their red number, and their green number is like. What's going to be like a great example for this? I can't do the math in my head. Like, let's say it's like their red number is like $50 and their green number is like 100,000, you know?
Sure.
Like the one person has given $5 million.
Yeah.
Right. When the other person is only given, you know, $499,000, whatever,
yeah.
$950. It's like they've given way more, but like ratio wise, it has been like the smaller number is like huge.
Well, I see what you're saying, where right. Where it's kind of like this is somebody who like has given a much better ratio relative to their net worth. I think that it would speak very quickly to the kind of people you might be dealing with altogether. Like, from a giving standpoint, the person who has $50 and they've given almost $500,000, it's like, to me, that would demonstrate somebody who has a very specific goal in life, which is pretty much just to give back everything they have.
Right.
Because that for all intents and purposes, that's the best argument you could make.
Right.
Is that that's who they are as a person.
I want to say there is like a parable in the Bible about this exact situation, wherein there's like some king or something who is, you know, doesn't want to like pay taxes, or he says, I've given, you know, he pays a ton of taxes and he still is very wealthy or whatever.
Sure.
And then there's some like beggar woman who gives Jesus like, you know, the only 2 pennies she has. And he says like, I tell you, she has given me more than you have ever given me or whatever.
Right.
You know, something like, I think that's the gist of it.
I understand, like, this is somebody who didn't have a lot to give, but still had the generosity of spirit to do the best they could.
Right.
And it's sort of like, that is much, much, much more telling. And I would say that the disparity between the parable, which absolutely makes sense to me, and then the example that we presented, where it's like, maybe you've given $500,000 and your net worth is 50, is I think that at some point in time, that kind of ratio would speak to the kind of person that you might have. Like, out here in the real world, we know people who are frugal, like,
yeah,
who are very specific about the way that they want to like live their life, what their priorities are. And I think on some level that can represent your values and like what's important to you. And like at some point it might start to like illustrate your character in a way that just like,
yeah,
it's the example working the way that maybe I hoped it could.
Well, okay. So the other thing that changes it, I feel like, is the public facing nature of it. Because one, like if you were, you know, if you know that it's going to say $50, but you've given $500,000, that might be opening doors for you anyway.
It could,
you know, like there's like that aspect. Like, okay, so there's a really funny episode, which is to say all of them, of Curb Your Enthusiasm.
I knew it was going to be Curb Your Enthusiasm.
You did?
Like, the second you started, I was like, I knew.
Oh, exactly. My God. Okay. So here's what happens is that Larry and his forever rival, Ted Danson, are both at this, you know, event for, I want to say it's like they're opening a new wing of a hospital or something like that. Sure. Right. And they have both given just, you know, horrendous sums of money to the hospital. And there's like a big wall listing all the donors or whatever. No.
And Ted Danson's name comes before.
No, okay. No. This is the thing, is that Larry's name is up there and he's given like, you know, like $2 million or something. And Ted has donated anonymously for $10 million or something, like some really big number.
Okay.
Right. But he donated it anonymously, but everyone knows it was him.
I see.
And so Larry is all upset and he's like, you didn't give, like, yeah, you didn't do it anonymously. Like, it's not, you're getting credit for doing the anonymous donation, but it's not anonymous because everyone knows.
Right.
Right. And it's like, and you know, Ted's trying to play it off like, nah, I don't care about any of that. You know, I just care about the hospital. It's like, then why don't you just give it to, why don't you put your name on it? And it's like, because I don't want people to know. And it's like, but everyone knows, you're telling everybody, you know?
Right. Yes.
It's like they're at this party and Larry's on to Ted, you know?
sure.
But like, he's also complaining that he donated money.
Under
false pretense or whatever.
That's, I mean, I understand the dilemma and the way that would play well for a sitcom, but I also think that my take on it would be like, ultimately, like the net good is the net good, you know, like that's what we want. We want the hospital to thrive.
Right.
And anything else is vanity.
Right.
You know, it's like, but
see, Larry would say it's all vanity.
It's all like, so he wants to have his name on the wall. And like, that's like the badge of honor. Like there are some things money can't buy. But sometimes what the thing money can buy is your name on the wall.
Right.
And it's worth a lot because it's an exclusive club. It's an exclusive opportunity to showcase what you are capable of.
Right.
Even if all of it is a piece of bronze with your name.
Right. But it appears even more generous to have not cared about it.
It seems even more generous
to have not cared about having your name on the wall.
Oh, right.
That's even more generous. Like, oh, you only donated to put your name on the wall. And it's like, I just donated because I care about the hospital. But it's like, but not if you still care that everyone knows you did it that way.
Right. Yes.
I was like, so with our other example, it's like, yeah, I donated all my money. It's like, because you know everyone can see that you're doing it.
Because yes. But okay. So here's the other thing too, is that like for me, like I think I brought this up before as well in the past, like the idea of being able to like retire someday is like something that I think the older I get, like I would be very hopeful towards. Like that's a goal that like it would be important to me. And so it's like something I put priority and you know, like resources into making sure happens eventually. But I also think that there could be two completely different arguments. Some people might be like, it is way more important to like use the money while you're like youthful, you know, like and have the opportunity to soak in the marrow of life, so to speak, you know. And it's like, so it could be the kind of thing where like excessive net worth, if you're never really doing much with it, you know, you're not like, you don't have that zest for life, that could be its own sort of like, well, like, or, like, why, you know, like, what's it for?
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
It's like, on some level, saving for the future is the responsible thing. But I think you could theoretically cross a line where it's like, you know, but is it preventing you from living now because you want to live when you're 65?
Right.
You know, and it's like, it's all a balancing act. So I think that there's a world where it's like you could have a lower number, but maybe that comes with a more fun lifestyle. And it doesn't necessarily mean a reckless lifestyle.
Right.
And I do think that we've used very, for the purposes of the conversation, we've tried to use examples that are more blatant,
right,
in nature, like that are more like aggressive. But I think that the actual nature of it would, like, it, you could learn a lot about people, I think, based on what these numbers indicated. And even to some people, if something was bad, to other people it might be good.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, like there's like a code to reading the numbers.
There's a code to reading the numbers. Because, like, let's say you're the 50 person net worth, 500,000 in donation thing. Like, that's a very specific life partner.
Right.
You know, like that's probably not the person who's going to want to go to wine country with you. Not that everybody needs to go to wine country, but some people might want to.
Right.
You know, but I suspect that person's not that person.
Right. Maybe not.
You know, so I think that you could learn a thing or two based on what those numbers were, and maybe like what it meant for how these people, you know, coalesced.
Right. Right. And then it's like at the end of it, it's just like, if you live in this world, does that make every single thing about money all of the time?
And that's a fair question as well. You're right. Like, cause then all of a sudden it's like the numbers become the medium, you know, versus other things that might matter more. It's just like, you know, character.
Right. Exactly.
Trustworthiness.
Right. Right.
Yeah, humor, you know, like, yeah. That's the other thing too. It's like, I love this person. They are hilarious. They are a riot to be with. They are so much fun. Their numbers are not the greatest.
Numbers are not the greatest. You know?
But maybe that's like one of those things where it's like, maybe it's better we don't know.
Yeah. It's probably
the whole point was just the general thought experiment, because that, I think, you know, that's why I kind of pitched it as a Black Mirror concept. That's what these shows are like. You know, they're taking an example. They're going to give you the most aggressive versions of all of it.
Yeah.
And kind of walk you through it. And all I would really hope with this entire conversation, because I don't have a point. I don't think there's a correct ratio. I don't think there's a correct number. I don't have any, like, you know, absolute position. The goal is just to talk about it.
Right. Yeah.
You know, like,
yeah. How would people read it or do it or whatever?
Or yeah. Would it change something about how you personally live?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Could be. I don't know.
There you go. Well, guys, thank you so much, as always, for tuning into this week's episode of The Pop. As always, if you have any feedback for us, you can send it over to popcornculturepod@gmail.com. Or if you'd like to support the show, you can do so at patreon.com/popcornculture. Otherwise, until next time,
pop, pop.
Today's episode was edited by Isabel Chrisley. Vaishawn Brandon does our art. Catherine Stein is our production manager. And the show is hosted by me and Jonathan Carlin.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.